Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
These days we talk about the Muslim world, its importance to American foreign policy, to public discussions in the U.S. Does not need to be overemphasized. The Muslim world has loomed large in our public imagination now for some time, and it's we know that it's a very critical issue and a very difficult issue for us to put our hands around, to understand, and also to deal with the issues that we see emanating from it. In particular, since 9/11, the question of extremism and the threat that is perceived coming from it in the West have been subject of ample public debate in the U.S., and we've sort of dwelt on it for some time. But rather than, go around one more time discussing whether Islam is a threat, whether the problem lies with Islam, how do we deal with the Muslim world, I thought that it's time that we looked at the problem completely differently, from a very different perspective. And that's what I'm trying to do in my book, Forces of Fortune. And essentially, the core issue is the following. When we think about Islamic fundamentalism or extremism, we have a set of arguments that have been amply articulated in media, in books, by politicians for some time. And they're a variation of one of three principal explanations. The first is that the problem lies with the religion itself, that somehow Islam is impervious to change, is opposed to modernity, and very easily supports or promotes extremist views or violence. The second argument has been that, no, that's not the case, that Islam in some ways represents socioeconomic grievances, that there is dictatorship and authoritarianism, there is poverty and class difference, and that's what Islamic fundamentalism or extremism represents or vocalizes, at least. So in a way, extremism or fundamentalism are surrogates for kinds of social forces that are fairly familiar to a lot of us. And the third one is that this is all about anti-colonialism or anti-imperialism or anti-occupation, that this is sort of what we're seeing in the Muslim world is a different version of what we saw in Southeast Asia or Latin America in the 1960s and 1970s. But I, looking at the Muslim world, and I have a lot of experience traveling there and dealing with these issues, I thought that there's a missing piece here. That there's too much focus on the symptom rather than the cause, and then very little attention paid to how do we move from here forward to somewhere else. And I thought that the missing piece in a lot of the discussion is the issue of middle class. Now, why does middle class matter? I mean, first of all, we can look everywhere else in the world. We can look at European history and or American history. We can see that stability, prosperity, moderation everywhere depends on the presence of a stable middle class. When we look at other places in the world that have made a transformation, such as Latin America, Asia, India, other parts of the world like Eastern Europe, what we see is the rise of a middle class, that the prosperity and democracy is anchored in a middle class. Now, if you looked at the Muslim world, we would see that this is by and large a missing class, that the sort of the social pyramid in the Muslim world is quite flat, means that it's very big at its bottom and small on the top, but the middle part is not really strong and is in some ways missing. So basically what I'm saying is that other problems may be there. There may be problems with the religion, there may be problems with the politics, but this is also one huge glaring problem, which is that the Muslim world is different from the other parts of the world that we've experienced, we've seen transform themselves in important ways, is that there is this missing class. Now, That's not to say that class issues don't matter in the Muslim world. I mean, if you remember the Iranian Revolution of 1979, which started this whole discussion about Islamic fundamentalism and Islam in politics, it was pretty much a class revolution. It was a rebellion of the lower classes against the monarchy, and without class, that revolution would not have happened. And the middle class was actually very important in that revolution. It supported, if you would, the overthrow of the monarchy and what ended up being an Islamic revolution. If you look much more recently, for instance, in the case of Pakistan, earlier this year, there was a major offensive by Taliban forces who took over large parts of northwest areas of Pakistan. And, from looking from far away, all we saw was that there was an extremist message. This was about Islamic law and a call to an Islamic state. But the reason why it was a successful offensive early on was that the Taliban had very simple message for local peasants. Any land you appropriate, you get to keep. So it was not so much, if you would, an Islamic assault as it was a very clear call to class war of mobilizing the lower classes against landlords and landowners and sort of putting it obviously in a rubric of a jihad against the government, but in reality appealing to class sentiments. Now, when you go around the Muslim world, there's plenty of wealth. I mean, you can look at countries like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, or if you've traveled, you see that there is a middle class, or middle class and above. So then, I often get asked, well, then, what are you talking about? It's not as if, the Middle East or the rest of the Muslim world doesn't have that class. But every middle class is not the right kind of middle class. If you looked at most of the Muslim world, its middle class was created by the governments. It was built top-down. It actually goes even before there were governments. When the British or the French arrived, they tried to create a class of natives who spoke English or French, dressed like Europeans, and then employed them as people who would work in the colonial administrations. When the British and the French left, these were the people who took over government, and they became your professional classes, and even businessmen, etc. But they are very different from our middle class. Our middle class is independent of government. It is a middle class because it generates wealth on its own, because it's tied to private sector market activity. In much of the Muslim world, the middle class is dependent on government. It's dependent on handouts, contracts, salaries from the government. It doesn't generate the wealth. A middle class in Saudi Arabia lives off of oil money. There's a huge difference between Saudi Arabia and South Korea. Because in South Korea, you have integration into the global economy, you have market economics, you have entrepreneurship and business that generates wealth, and the middle class is born of that generation of wealth. Whereas in many parts of the Muslim world, whether it's in Egypt or it's in Saudi Arabia, the middle class is dependent on the government. That's not the right kind of middle class. That's not the one that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the one that looks like the one we have or looks like the one that the Koreans have, a real middle class. And my argument is that much of the problem that we encounter in the Muslim world is because that kind of middle class doesn't exist. Now, why does it matter? And I repeat, because if we looked at European history, if you looked at other parts of the Third World, Latin America, Eastern Europe, China, Asia, India. This middle class is the pivot of prosperity, economic growth, and democracy. That without it, it wouldn't happen. So, in one way, you could say, what happened in Latin America in the past 20 years that it went from dictatorship to democracy? We could say, yes, they changed their laws, etc. But end of the day, the critical issue is that the economy has changed to allow the rise of a middle class that is like middle classes everywhere else. It's tied to markets and it's tied to trade around the world. Now, the good news is that there has been a gradual opening in many parts of the Muslim world, that we are seeing the rise of that right kind of middle class. And where we're seeing this rise of the right kind of middle class, we are also seeing very positive results. And I go through this in the book. For instance, there are countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, Dubai in the Middle East, or Turkey, where we are seeing a very different trend at work than maybe in other parts of the Muslim world. And it's not a coincidence why we're seeing positive things in these places. These are places that are much more than anywhere else integrated into the global economy, that they have much more open economic systems, and that they have, as a result, a middle class that is dependent on commerce and trade and is integrated into the global economy. Where the Muslim world is farthest from the global economy, where the economies are insular, when there is no real trade with the rest of the world, you also have the greatest degree of both instability and extremism. And the reason is because the values of the middle class tend to support moderation, tend to support democracy, and are essentially world-affirming. Because those who generate wealth want to live it well in the world as well. They consume and live in ways that that would not go well with rejection, war with the world, and closed sort of political ideas. Now, who do we mean by middle class? Generally, the economists define the middle class as those who are not too rich or not too poor, sort of the middle belt. In a sort of a tip of the finger definition, many economists say, and middle class means somebody who has formal employment, who has a regular income, and at least a third of their disposable income could go to things they want to buy, other than food and shelter. So if they put that aside, at least they have a third, after they've paid for food and shelter, at least they have a third of their disposable income available to spend as they wish. Some people, go further and say a middle class can also be defined in terms of values, namely that, for instance, believing in small family, investing in family, investing in quality of life. Now, by any of these definitions, say in the past 20, 30 years, the size of the middle class in the Muslim world has doubled. There are countries in which you could say it's about 30 to 40% of the population, but even in countries that, like Pakistan, which we see as right now a major sort of source of instability and difficulty, at least 10 to 15% of the population would qualify as middle class and above. So it's not a small piece of the pie. Now, in most places, it is not free enough to take flight, to define the trends in society, to define culture, to define politics. But where it has, we're seeing very interesting results. And, I went and looked for their footprint. In other words, where do we see the impact of this middle class, and then what kind of an impact we see? And I thought one of the most interesting places to begin to look was the little emirate of Dubai. I don't know how many of you have gone to Dubai, or it's a little city-state, kind of like a little Singapore or Hong Kong, on the shores of the Persian Gulf. In the past 20 years or so, it became fabulously wealthy. And it also became a place of spectacular extravaganza with, the world's tallest building, the world's largest, mall, which has an indoor ski resort in it. It became sort of a playground for businessmen, financiers, consumers. It's now a major tourist destination for Europeans and the like. Now, since the global economy has tanked, Dubai hasn't done very well. A lot of the buildings are not being built. There's been unemployment. A lot of the foreigners are leaving. But that, to me, is not what's interesting or uninteresting about Dubai. Places rise and fall. Miami went through the same cycle as well at some point in time. What's interesting about Dubai is that Dubai doesn't have much oil. In fact, it's the poorest of the little emirates of the Gulf. And as it didn't have oil, it began to think about, how it can make money. And it came up with the idea of changing its laws and regulations to be business-friendly, to create a business-friendly environment in which people from elsewhere could come and do business. And also it thought of creating a sort of a playground which appeals to sort of middle-class taste, something I would say a cross between Rodeo Drive, Disneyland, and Las Vegas. I mean, that's what Dubai became. But what was fascinating was that, you know, people, it's not the Arab population of Dubai, but it's that Dubai became the place that Muslims went from everywhere else who couldn't do business in their own countries in a free market environment. They went to Dubai and they engaged in this open economic system, and they made a lot of money, and they behaved like middle classes and free marketeers and entrepreneurs everywhere else. So they made money, they lost money. And also Dubai became, if you would, the single most important destination for middle classes everywhere in the Muslim world. So, you know, when people took polls of Muslims in many countries, they said that Dubai is the place they want to visit, more so than coming to the West for vacation. Why? Because the way Dubai was, it became a paradise for middle classes across the region. So their desire, their consumption desire of the Muslim middle class is not some rigid, fundamentalist place. The middle class conception of consumption in the Muslim world is somewhere which is, a cross between Las Vegas, Rodeo Drive, and Disneyland. And largest numbers of people in the Muslim world said that Dubai is the one place they would live other than their own countries. Or some said more so than their own countries. And and when you look at it again, you know that you see that when Muslims become genuine middle classes, they consume and behave like middle classes everywhere else, which means it all becomes about consumption and about investment in quality of life. Now, they may want things a bit differently than Westerners would. So, but ultimately, that the culture of the middle class in the Muslim world is life-affirming and is very capitalist and is very consumerist. I mean, Dubai is all about consumption. It's a hugely consumerist culture. Now, one of the things that is very interesting is, and we see a lot of it in Dubai, is that is that the things that this new Muslim middle class wants to consume are clearly have to be in line with their religious sensibilities, which means that just because Muslims become middle class doesn't mean they become secular. And in fact, if we think that's a definition of being modern in the Middle East, we've got it wrong. The Muslim middle class, the up-and-coming Muslim middle class, is a lot more like middle class in small-town America or in the heartland in America. In other words, they are economically modern and want to participate in the market and understand the rules of a free market system. I want to take advantage of it. They want to consume and live well, but they also believe in moral values and religious values. So middle classhood is not the same thing as being secular. And in fact, this up-and-coming middle class very clearly has all the sort of similar tonalities that the middle class in America has. In the sense of combining capitalist values and consumerist values with religion. One of the things that, for instance, is interesting is that is the rise of what is known as Islamic finance. Now, Islamic law does not permit either paying interest rates or receiving interest rates. It sees it as usury. And believes that it's having economic gain without effort, and it also creates injustice and inequality in society. Pious Muslims, always had difficulty of operating in regular financial systems because they're all interest based. And you know, for 2-3 decades, there were all these clerics and Islamic thinkers who kept talking about Islamic finance, that maybe you can have finance without interest rates. It never worked. Governments would adopt it as a way of sort of public relations with their more religious citizens. So they would subsidize an Islamic bank here or an Islamic bank there. But it was clearly obvious that Islamic banking wasn't working. Then about 10 years ago, the picture changed. Islamic finance became a money-making big business. It became a money-making big business because large Western financial institutions, Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, HSBC, put their mind to making it profitable. Well, you know, financiers are constantly looking for ways to create financial products that allows them to make money. I mean, you can have subprime mortgage, or you can have Islamic financing. The important thing is that these large banks understood there's a market here. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother to make it work. Why did they think there is a market here? Because they understood that there is a up-and-coming class with a lot of wealth that wants a particular kind of product. So it wants to participate in the financial, global financial institutions, but it wants to do so in conjunction with its own values. And the wealthier the middle class is becoming, the larger the size of Islamic finance is becoming, and it's becoming global business. For instance, now City of London is emerging as a major center for Islamic finance, and the target is very clearly middle class. For instance, in Chicago, about 2 years ago, a bank announced that it would provide Islamic car loans, which means interest-free car loans. And they couldn't keep up with the demand within the first 2 days. Now, an Islamic car loan is directed at somebody that's buying a car, which means that somebody who has disposable income to buy a car, which means middle class and above. So it's not a kind of an Islamic product that is targeted at the poor. It is exactly targeted at that middle level of society. And as Islamic finance grows, it's an indicator that that middle part of society is growing. And, you know, its footprint is everywhere. Many large companies in the West have understood that if you sort of float an Islamic bond, there are more people who wouldn't buy a regular bond who may buy an Islamic bond. For instance, Ford Motor Company bought Aston Martin with the issuance of an Islamic bond. Caribou Coffee, which is the second largest coffee chain in America, is owned by an Islamic mutual fund, which financed its purchase with an Islamic bond. There are now sovereign Islamic bonds being issued. Governments from China to Thailand to European countries are tapping into this phenomenon. So very clearly, you know, when you look at things like Islamic finance, but it's not the only one. There's also growth in, for instance, Islamic vacation packages, housing, etc., all of which are essentially goods that typically middle classes buy. That it's very clear that, you know, you have a rise of a middle class there. Now, in short form, that means that, you know, extremism is not the only story that's happening over there. It's the one that obviously concerns us and captivates our attention. But there's something else also going on in the Muslim world, and that potentially can be far more important for the things we care about. And let me give you an example of another country, which I think would bring out why this is important. I don't know how many of you have been to Turkey. It's now, you know, it's become another, if you would, major success story. City of Istanbul and Turkey are now sort of one of the hottest destinations for Europeans and Americans to visit. Turkey has become a major global player. When there was a G20 meeting in Pittsburgh recently, which is a gathering of the 20 richest economies of the world, Turkey is a member of that. It's been growing very rapidly. It now has had a fairly stable democracy since 2002, which is, and even maybe a little longer, which is close to a decade of a stable democracy. And it's economically completely almost integrated into the global economy and European economy. Now, there are many things that about Turkey that are peculiar. First of all, it's a very educated country. It had a lot of infrastructure. It also had several decades of very rigid secularism that impacted large portion of the country. But Turkey has not become a prosperous Muslim democracy because of the secularism. That's not what has got Turkey to where it is. Turkey has got there because of this rise of a new Muslim middle class. And when you go to Turkey, you understand what I'm saying very clearly. On one side, you have these large city middle class, which are very secular, which were product of decades of government education and push for secularism. But they, economically, they depend on salaries from the government or large enterprises that are protected by the government. And then you go to small town Turkey, there are these people, they call them the Anatolian Tigers, small town businessmen, much like small town businessmen in America, who are very religious, who are very conservative, but who are already integrated into the global economy. And they are the engine of economic growth in Turkey. So, you know, there are two middle classes in Turkey. One secular, you know, was tied to the state. The other one, which is religious, but is tied to the market. We don't even know which one is more modern in our thinking. Culturally, the other one looks more modern, but in reality, economically and in terms of what we understand as where global economy and global culture is going, the small town religious businessmen are far more important. Now, about 20 years ago, Turkey was bankrupt economically. It doesn't have oil. It didn't have anything to pump money into it. The government was massively in debt. And hat in hand, the Turks went to the International Monetary Fund, which is this economic agency in Washington, D.C., that lends money to governments, but it also forces them to undertake changes. It's kind of like, you know, going to a bank for an emergency loan, but then them getting conditionalities on all the things that you need to do correctly. So the IMF told Turkey that it had to change its economy. It had to remove its tariff barriers. It had to stop subsidizing these large, bloated, red ink industries. It had to put money into small businesses who could actually export something so could earn the country some money. And it basically had to open itself to the world. It had to change its laws so that a foreign businessman from Germany and the United States would be willing to put money in Turkey. And it had to also create an environment where Europeans would buy things that the Turks made. It was very painful for about 10 years. It caused unemployment, it caused downturns. It's almost like, you know, telling GM that it needs to shut down or it needs to restructure itself. Obviously, people resist it if they can, but the Turks couldn't resist it. And consequently, there was a birth of a new middle class in the middle of Turkey. Let me give you an example. There is a little town. It's not that little anymore, but in the middle of Turkey, it's called Kayseri, where it's a small town with people are very conservative. You have businessmen there who produce, you know, invest, etc. But they believe in family values, small town family values, very religious. But what is important about that town is that 7%. Of all denim jeans in the world are produced in that town. There's one company that accounts for 1% of all denim jeans. There's not a single global brand. In fact, I'm sure we're all wearing, somebody in this room is wearing denim from Kayseri. There's not one global brand that doesn't buy denim from Kayseri. The town also sells furniture globally. They sell leather directly to fashion houses in Europe. It is, in other words, it's directly tied to the global economy, not through the Turkish government. It is not like the Turkish government is giving money to these businessmen. It is not like the Turkish government, they depend on the government for money. Basically, they make their own deals with Europe and the United States. It's the same way these Turkish businessmen in that little town work the same way as businessmen in Mexico or in Hungary or in India or in China are operating. In other words, they're part of the global economic supply chain. Now, you look at them, it's kind of like Dubai. I mean, in Kayseri, there's sort of, you know, you go to this shiny mosque that they all build with their own money. There's a line of Mercedes-Benzes outside. It's all about who's got the bigger house, who's got the more cars, and who's a larger player. But you also see what is much more important is not that whether they're religious or not. They're very religious. But they prefer a kind of religiosity that is capitalism friendly, that is business friendly, that is trade friendly. In other words, if you are selling denim to Levi Strauss, or you're selling leather to Ferragamo in Milan, you very well understand yourself that jihad is not good for business. It is not because we preach to them that you should moderate your religion. It is not because their government has any authority over them. It is in their own personal interest to preserve their ties to the global economy. It is in their own interest to preserve the image of Turkey, because it's a brand now. You know, when you go to Walmart or you go to, you know, any shop down on State Street, you can find T-shirts or other things that says "Made in Turkey" on it. And therefore, their vested interest lies in a kind of transformation in Turkey that is in the positive direction. Now, these businessmen have supported a moderate Muslim party, which is now the government of Turkey. Now, this moderate Muslim party, its main, if you would, innovation was that it voluntarily gave up on the demand for an Islamic state or implementation of Islamic law. Now, there were pressures from the military, from the West, for it to do as well, but there was also pressure from below, from its base, from particularly these businessmen, who favor, I would say in many ways, a sort of an American formula. Namely, you want family values, you want religion in public life, you want religion in your life, but you don't want an Islamic state, and you don't want a combative religion at war with the world. Why? Because they are part of that world. Many other parts of the Muslim world, when you look, that kind of vested interest doesn't exist. I mean, we really don't see at Walmart many goods that says "Made in the Arab World" on it. There are very few businessmen in the Arab world. I don't want to say there are none. There are, and that's why it's a critical issue to help them to become as important, as powerful as the Turkish ones. I mean, we saw that in Dubai. Dubai, the mentality was very much like that of Turkey. But where there is no relationship with the global economy, there's no vested interest in it. There is no self-corrective pressure coming from the marketplace to impact their thinking. And we can see that, you know, this up-and-coming middle class is very interested everywhere else also in a new kind of a discussion about Islam. For instance, one of the most popular preachers in the Muslim world is a fellow by the name of Amar Khalid. He's an Egyptian. He now actually lives in London, but he has four very, very popular television shows that broadcast on satellite television into the Arab world. His following is in the tens of millions who watch him. And then, you know, he has CDs and books and, you know, YouTube clips. And then he also holds town hall sort of, you know, meetings in hotels, large hotels. And again, you know, thousands of people go to hear him. Now, Amar Khalid is an interesting phenomenon, not because he preaches secularism or he talks about some kind of Protestant reformation in Islam, which seems for a long time to have been our obsession here. He's conservative. He favors women observing modest dress and headscarves, and he believes in Islamic family values and living by the religion. But at the same time, he preaches to his audience a modernity, business-friendly Islam that emphasizes on Islam as values rather than Islam as political action, that emphasizes harmony and coexistence as opposed to confrontation. Now, who goes to Amar Khalid, you know, meetings at hotels? I mean, the very fact that they are in hotels tells you that there's a certain class that can go to hotels. Or who is his main consumer? It is that middle class. So that middle class is interested in religion, but that's not the relevant part of the discussion. It's interested in other things that are much more important. Now, my argument is that, the success cases like Dubai or Turkey, to us, should be proof of concept. Namely, if you have an integration of Muslims into the global economy, it does have a cultural impact, political impact on those societies. A kind of cultural and political impact that the West has been, you know, yearning for but and has been preaching the Muslims about, but does not know how to get them there. But when you also look at even other places in the Muslim world, we think that the battle is between extremism and moderation or between secularism and religion, but the real battle is between this rising middle class and other social forces in society. For instance, if we took the case of Iran, I think many of you probably saw pictures on CNN and television about the protests that happened after the elections in Iran. Now, you know, we can very easily define what we saw in terms of a fight for democracy, demand by, a segment of the population for greater freedoms, rejection of the ruling regime, etc. But this wouldn't have happened in Iran if there wasn't the rise of a new middle class in Iran. Now, we don't even associate with this kind of discussion with Iran, but we should. You know, Iran began going through a process of privatization when the oil prices were very low in the 1990s. The government had a great deal of difficulty. It wasn't making enough money, even though it's an oil-rich country. It began to open up its economy. And the opening of the economy did create, if you would, oligarchs, you know, sort of large barons who control large parts of the economy. But they are also private sector actors. And they cannot act on their own. So the space that they created, also a private sector began to work in Iran. So yes, a major ayatollah would get a large deal in telecommunications, but he cannot create cell towers and a cell phone network on his own. He has to subcontract that to an engineering company and then subcontract the accounting to an accounting company, etc. So you had a rise of a private sector in Iran. And by the late 1990s, there was very clearly that there was enormous amount of prosperity in Iran. And the middle class was consuming more, was gradually the class divide that the revolution was supposed to have put away was coming back to Iran. Now, when that middle class began to, and still does, ask for things that middle classes ask for, which is middle classes ask for quality of life, freedom to enjoy life, cultural opening, and a rule of law and a political system that is supportive of business. And obviously they want an opening to the world, because the more you open to the world, there's more business opportunity. Now, who opposes them? Those who depend on entitlements from the government, who have no vested interest in the global economy, and are not also interested in what the middle class would like to consume and own. Now, there is the civil society activism that has been challenging the government in Iran, that was behind the elections, behind the protests, before that was supportive of the reformist movements, has its roots in that private sector. Without that private sector, you would not have had this opening in Iran. They didn't win last summer because they're not big enough. But last summer would not have happened if they hadn't been there at all. So in some ways, the battle line in Iran is also over free markets and the economic basis for that middle class. Now, what does all of this mean, say, for us, as we think about the Muslim world, as we worry about extremism, as we worry about, you know, a lot of the questions we've had about the Muslim world? One is that, contrary to a lot of assertions, Muslim world can change. But it will not change because of preaching, or it will not change by force from the outside. It would have to change with the same force that changed the West. We didn't arrive where we are because of the Reformation. We arrived where we are because of the rise of market economy and trade in the West. Capitalism was a transformative force that produced the modern West. And capitalism is the transformative force that is changing China. China's not changing because of we're lecturing it. Or China's not changing because there's some grand debate about democracy somewhere happening. China's changing because of the forces of global capitalism. This is not rocket science to us, but somehow in thinking about the Muslim world, we factored it out. And there's plenty of evidence that transformation will happen and can happen. We don't need to worry about Muslims figuring out moderation. What we need to figure out is how can you introduce to the Muslim world the forces that ultimately will change the entire political economic context in the Muslim world in which the discussions about religion, politics, extremism, etc. are taking place. Now, you know, for a very long time, when we listen about, you know, who's the change agent in the Muslim world, we often think that it's probably some enlightened cleric or a, you know, reformist intellectual. Let me give you news. That's not it. Plenty of them are around. They all live in the West and write in English and go and lecture tours here. Nobody reads them. The change agent in the Muslim world is the businessman. The process is economic, and it has already begun in many ways. And the story in the Muslim world is the extremism is not the only story. It's the one that rightly, you know, preoccupies us. But there is another large force that is beginning to take shape, and in some places like Malaysia, Indonesia, Turkey and Dubai, it's already had a very profound effect, and there are many other places where it's working its way, countries like Morocco, Jordan, etc., that it is also has been working on the economy.
One of the things that puzzles me as an American watching the large Muslim movement in the world is if this middle class is growing and assumably is going to gain in power and voice, where I don't hear, and maybe our media is not covering it, I don't hear the outcry from the moderate Muslim against the radical Islamist, and do you feel that this middle class that you see rising, are they going to be able to influence the radicalism?
Well, very good point. First of all, you're not hearing it because they're not covering it. I mean, that's the simplest answer. Secondly, you know, the key issue to think about is not whether at the right time other people will stand up to condemn things in the same way that we expect of them or at the time we expect of them. The more important issue is whether inherently they are supportive of it or not. It's very clear that, for instance, in the case of Turkey, as I was saying, there is plenty of criticism of U.S. policy or of European policies. But generally, there is no support for militant extremist reactions to it. Now, the Turks may not stand up and condemn just because we expect them to. Although there have been plenty of it. I don't mean to say it hasn't. We don't get coverage of that. When 9/11 happened, there was over 200 condemnations by clerics from across the Muslim world. But, you know, none of it gets actually reflected. But that's not an issue. I mean, we're not really looking for condemnation as a sort of a satisfaction to ourselves. What we really ought to be looking for is that extremists, when they occur, ought to be marginal, exceptional elements in a society that it doesn't have a basis. They don't have broad support in that society. Now, we are seeing that where you have a middle class that is vested in relations with the rest of the world, that its attitudes are not supportive of extremism, that extremism is strongest where there is most insular economies and systems connecting to the rest of the world. So yes, you know, in Yemen or in the Gulf countries, we see a lot of extremism, but these are not economies or societies that are in any way integrated into the global economy. Now, in many other places, what we have is neither zero middle class nor middle class triumphing. It is a battle. And the middle class will triumph if these countries are forced to open up, like Turkey, to embrace the global economy. I mean, you know, one of the key issues is that it remains a fact that the Muslim world is the largest part of the, you know, surface of the earth, largest portion of the population, that by and large sits outside of the global economy. And in the Arab world, the insularity is most. And that's one of the reasons why you have more radicalism there. And that's obviously a factor that we cannot ignore.
Is oil the problem? Could you comment on that?
Yes, it is. For the reason that oil and where is a lot of it, and it's not oil alone, it's sometimes also international aid to countries. It allows countries to try to avoid the kind of economic changes that force Turkey to open up. So, I mean, if you have money coming from the ground, then you really don't need entrepreneurs to generate wealth. You see, the big difference between, our middle class and, say, middle class in, an oil-rich country is that we depend on the wealth that the middle class and the wealthy above the middle class generate. They pay taxes, they support the economy, and that there then you end up with a Boston Tea Party also contract that, therefore they demand democracy in exchange for that. That kind of a contract doesn't exist in an oil country. If the population doesn't account for your wealth, and rather it is you who are giving them the money, why would you need to listen to them? And why do you need to, and they're not, you don't need to, have them produce things that Europeans buy, because it's oil money. So, there is a reason why, Dubai was the one who did what it did, and it became Dubai, because Dubai needed the money from trade, because it didn't have oil money. And therefore, we shouldn't confuse wealth that is generated by oil with wealth that is generated by trade and commerce. There is a difference between South Korea and Saudi Arabia. South Korea makes wealth from nothing, a country that is totally resource poor, whereas Saudi Arabia lives off of wealth that comes out of the ground. We want, most of the Muslim world to be South Korea's. Turkey has become South Korea in a way. We don't want them to rely on handouts from the outside. We don't want a population that lives off of entitlements. You want the population to be generating wealth.
What is the role of the Western governments when it comes to the supporting the governments of the oil-producing countries in the Middle East? Is it somehow they're satisfied with the pseudo-stable governments there because they're giving enough oil? And also following that, I was wondering how the middle class have the chance of growing in such countries when they're usually being challenged by a lot of regulations empowered by the government.
Well, let me put it this way. Actually, the best thing we can do is actually try to look at the Muslim world very differently from the way we do. Let's not focus on the oil-rich countries. Let's focus on everybody else, which is a lot much larger part, and which actually has much more potential of transformation, which to various degrees may already be participating in the global economy. I mean, we have a tendency to see the entire 1.5 billion Muslims through the prism of a small group of countries in the heartland of the Arab world, and that's a huge mistake. The Muslim world is, the Arabs are only about 250 million out of the 1.5 billion. The overwhelming majority of Muslims are not Arabs. The largest countries are not there. And in fact, the news outside of the Arab world is a lot better than the news inside the Arab world. And there's a lot more chances of having an impact on countries outside of there. And then why focus on countries that are so oil wealthy that actually have absolutely no interest in this transformation? There's plenty of other countries that you know, can benefit from the wealth. Take the case of, for instance, Indonesia. We hardly hear about it. Probably the only reason we heard about it was because the president went to school there. So for a while it got coverage in the U.S. Look at Indonesia. You know, since the Bali bombings happened there in 2002, there's still some terrorists in Indonesia. They blew up a hotel only 2 months ago. But what is very clear is that Indonesia has steadily, over the past decade, has been moving in the right direction. In its last elections, the Islamic parties lost ground, and the president's party actually defeated a number of fundamentalist parties in head-to-head contest. When the last bombing happened in Indonesia, there was absolutely no support, I mean, to that first point for it. There was a huge condemnation from the varieties of places in Indonesia, and the population cooperated, with the main culprit being apprehended fairly quickly. There's always going to be terrorists. There were also terrorists in Italy, in Germany a decade ago, causing mayhem. But in Indonesia, we saw what we want to see, which is the population as a whole is not interested in this. Why? Because Indonesia is integrating into the global economy. The process began about 20 years ago. It's made great strides. You do actually buy things that says made in Indonesia here. They are selling things. The middle class has grown over the past 10 years. So why aren't we focusing on Indonesia? I think, you know, if we put our mind to getting Indonesia over the hill, it'd be a lot better. It's the single largest Muslim country of 220 million people. Almost as many Muslims are Indonesians as there are in the entire Arab world. So, you know, part of this is our own problem. We're focused on on only one part of the Muslim world, which tends to be most insular, most difficult, and where most of the trouble is. And there's a lot other low-hanging fruit we can focus on.
It seems to me that in the aftermath of the summer's election turmoil, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's recent actions, such as his rhetoric on Holocaust denial and the nuclear issue, is just saber-rattling, designed to curry favor with his political base, such as the religious establishment and the Revolutionary Guard. What are some pragmatic and prudent strategies that the Obama administration should pursue to avoid overreacting to his bluster and further empower the growing Iranian middle class?
Well, on the specifics of that, I cannot comment for exactly the same reason. But, you know, generally the point is this, is that, there are short-run things and short-run issues that we have to figure out with Iran and its nuclear program. And there are long-run things that are important. Iran has a lot of potential for the reason that it is a country of 70 million. It has literacy rate of 85% plus in it. As we saw in the summer, it's a very tech-savvy population that in some ways is already integrated, at least on the information technology side, into the global mainstream. And that it has already lived under an Islamic fundamentalist regime and therefore, wants to look past it. So the question is, as I put it there, that the main issue in Iran is that the pivot of change will come as a consequence of settling the direction of the economy and the middle class in Iran, which is most interested in transformation. And, you know, we have to think in long run how best to bring Iran out of its insularity. So, dealing with nuclear issue or dealing with, what this president right now says is the stuff that, any diplomatic effort or a government has to deal with on an immediate basis. But the long-run issue matters more, which is, how you can break the isolation of this large country in a very key location. And that would have an impact on its economic integration into the world. So the problem in Iran, in my opinion, immediate problems are political or security or diplomatic, but the long-run puzzle we have to solve with Iran is actually economic.
I'm especially interested in the Israeli-Arab conflict. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could, have you already seen ways in which that conflict has been affected by this change in the Muslim middle class? And secondly, are there ways that the rest of the world could do more to support those changes?
Well, you know, that conflict is very specific. It's about land, and it's about, a mutually exclusive, if you would, views of the future of the territories and issues of security for Israel and issues of security for the Palestinians. I mean, those are sort of nuts and bolts issues that, have to be figured out. They're sort of in black and white. What is important is that the context in which these issues get debated in the rest of the Muslim world obviously would have to do with the context. I mean, if you looked at, say, Turkey, the Turkish government has taken a much more harder line than in the past about these issues. Last year at the international conference, the Turkish prime minister launched into the Israeli prime minister very heavily over the Gaza war, criticized them publicly. It became headline news everywhere. But then, Turkey still has, a defense pact with Israel. There's, daily flights between the countries. There's trade between them. And there's a lot of still give and take. And the population also has a very sort of a very set view about how this conflict ought to be resolved and where who says what and who's right and who's wrong. But the middle class in Turkey, and to the extent that they control the media and they control various outlets, is not interested in this issue derailing their relations with Israel, their relations with the West. They're not interested in radicalism in that sense. Now, there's another side to it too, is that if there were to be far more business activity and business relations between the Palestinians and Israelis in a direct fashion, it would also change the environment in which those populations and therefore their governments would approach that. Already, for instance, we're seeing in the West Bank in the past 5-6 years, there has been double-digit economic growth. There's a rise of a Palestinian middle class in the West Bank, which we're not seeing in Gaza. And that's one reason why the West Bank's environment is so different from Gaza. Gaza doesn't have a middle class. It's becoming a hugely poor society with no economic activity. West Bank is becoming economically much more prosperous. The only missing link is that economic prosperity in Gaza has to have a direct linkage to Israel. You want businessmen in these two countries to depend on one another, to have a vested interest in better relations. And then you want them to push their leaders rather than we constantly bringing them over here and lecturing them. You want they force their own prime ministers and their own leaders to accept compromises or give them political cover. Difficult issue could be perhaps better solved if you put it in a different context than the one we have right now.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.